Well, this is a continuation of yesterday's talk about rates. This is a paper we published with Isan Wall, Philip Kozelowski, and Chan Wen Han. I'm a graduate student in Oxford. So instead of the typical picture of Taiwan A, let's put arrow 56. So yesterday we finished here, I think. These are the supernova rate from the SNS people. And they are saying that there is a small component of all time delays and a dominant component of short time delays. So this could be proportional to the subformation history, depending on when to choose, and this is proportional to the mass. So this point is causing trouble. When this is confirmed, then we can really continue talking about rates, I think. Like at this moment, we are going to be waiting for that. So what's the idea? How can we derive the time delay of type 1A supernova, comparing the star formation history and the supernova rate? So the main idea is to try to parameterize the time delay distribution with a typical time delay tau that gives you a supernova rate depending on redshift and the typical time delay. So this, very importantly, depends on the star formation history. And it's not, I don't think there's a big agreement on what the best star formation history is. And this is a parameterized time delay distribution that is arbitrary. You can use two components, you can use exponential, you can use power law, and try and see what happens. So then, you can play the number of supernova you should see at a given redshift per solid angle. And this depends on this supernova rate, the effective time that you're looking at the supernova, so it's the total time times the probability of detecting the supernova, time dilation factor, and cosmology. So then you use Bayes theorem, and you conclude that the probability of the given time delay is proportional to this quantity. Or you can use a Boutons of fit test. So this has been done, by Gayam and Mao, 2004, Stroger et al, 2004, and Barry Santoni as well, 2006. So what we, at the beginning, we saw the results were Stroger et al, with this data point at high redshift, where there are no many supernova. They were claiming that the time delays are the order of 4 gigayears. So that would completely erase all the single layer channel, for instance, and other scenarios. But after a talk with Guillaume Blanc, and now he's in Paris, he pointed out to us that some star formation histories follow better the short time delays compared to the supernova rate. So the star formation history is not, there's not an agreement between the optical, infrared, and fossil record, etc. So here, just to show you different versions of the star formation history. This line and this line are the star formation histories using the Boots field supernova data. This line is a star formation history derived from the cosmic infrared background. So basically, light is reprocessed as dust emission. And this line here is based on the fossil record, so in the nearby universe, you look at galaxies and try to reconstruct the main population of the galaxy. And these are based on 24 micron Spitzer data with different luminosity functions.
But nothing's dropping at 1.5. Even if you take all those weird ones.
None of them. Yeah. No, I think there's a problem with all of them. The droplets.
You gotta need a long delay in that one. If you want to fit
that one. Yeah, so the main point for our paper is the position of this peak compared to the position of the supernova rate will determine the time delay. You just see here what is the peak? I don't know. But here there are 3 gigayears difference. So there's obviously going to be a strong dependence on this, the choice of star formation history and the time delay you derive. So here are some binary population synthesis time delays from Zhang, Wen, and Kozielowski 2004. The double degenerate channel follows a power law given by the merging time of the two white dwarfs. The single degenerate channel is one possibly Gaussian or one peak given by the stable hydrogen burning in the single degenerate channel. And these are the functions, the parameterized functions used to constrain time delays.
Sorry, I thought I understood then when you said that. I'm not sure I do. Because as was being talked about yesterday or the day before, the total time delay is the progenitor's, you know, main sequence time scale to which you add something like, I guess what you're saying here is that something that's kind of like a Gaussian, but that progenitor time scale is not a negligible part of this.
No, this is from star formation to explosion.
This is from a star burst.
Yeah. So because to get the progenitor, if he's thinking it has to be a high mass white, you know, star making, you know, like a 6 or 7 sort of mass star to make your massive white dwarf. That's not adding up.
Yeah, but that's not the right time scale.
No, the time scale, I'm surprised at how short that is, because you do expect that some of the donor stars would be stars that may have 2 solar masses, for example.
Nine.
And so their time evolution scale, the time until they're ready to start giving mass to the white dwarf, would be a little bit longer. But maybe what you're saying is that in your population synthesis, these stars don't contribute anything.
That's the dotted curve. Huh? That's the ones with the super stars.
The solid curve, the double degenerate, that should have the shortest
minimum delay.
Yeah, which it does.
Because this delay is short dash dotted, simply because they put in the calculations stabilization guidelines, which allows you to have more massive companions.
But there should still be some lower mass companions that do it too.
Lower mass companions contribute to longer.
Yeah, you can.
But you know, they don't have it in longer.
But I mean, you can compare this.
So just remind us that there are 2 curves there that are actual population synthesis.
Yeah, this is this is double degenerate, and these are just arbitrary parametrizations.
Right.
And they don't look much alike. That's one thing you notice. I mean, this exponential decay doesn't look too much like a power.
So what you're saying, the dash dotted curve contains both the main sequence lifetime and the time for the accretion to occur onto the white dwarf.
For their population synthesis.
Yes, this is Zhang, Wen, Kozielowski 2004.
That's a super soft source channel with thermal mass transfer. Thermal mass transfer, you've got to have a higher mass donor. You can't do it at 10 gigahertz if that's the channel. That's all.
Yeah. This is CO plus main sequence star.
Right.
So this power law is what you will get if you don't take into account the main sequence, just assume that the distributions are flat, the separations are flat, and just take these formulas for the gravitational gradient. So it's not very different from that.
Sorry, how do you get that?
This is not true, but if you assume that the after common envelope, the distribution of separations is flat, you will get this power law. And in the population synthesis, you get something similar. So this is a common feature of all the double degenerate scenarios. And this is a common feature of the single degenerate CO plus my sequence. So, just to remind you, these are the supernova from the Woods field. Just so you can see the redshift. These are taken from 2 fields, the Chandra Deep Field South and the Hubble Deep Field North. And what Stroger et al. Did is assume Jabalisco et al. Star formation history, the optical extinction-corrected optical subformation history, use parameterized models, and derive the typical time delay. So what they conclude is that the typical time delay should be of the order of 3.5 gigayears. So it's a very important result if it's true.
So again, what's the goods, you know, weighting of ellipticals versus star-forming galaxies, blah, 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 blah? Because now you're going from just saying what's happening in star-forming galaxies or something, you're trying to compare, you know, what the typical thing is. So if we, as we saw earlier, typically these things are weighted by the ellipticals way, way, way too much, then that's just, you know, fitting to this curve means nothing.
Well, I'm not sure, because I'll show later that the galaxy people find the young population in ellipticals, in many of them, find populations of the order of 1 gigayear, many ellipticals. So I'm not entirely convinced that there are very long time delays. I'll show you.
Right. But I mean, if indeed to make a fair sample, you know, a real fair sample of the, you know, of the masses of galaxies, you need to weight the spirals by a heck of a lot more than typically is done in these surveys. And this is going to change that redshift distribution completely.
I don't understand, because this, they just look at one fixed field. They're not selecting the galaxies. It's like a rolling.
So you're saying the Goods survey is not, is a completely fair sample?
Yes. I mean, at least they're not selecting galaxies. They're just looking at a fixed piece of the sky, like the sunrise people.
Yeah, that works. That's true. Yeah.
So
it's
not magnitude limited in any way?
Well, yeah,
but that does
it
itself introduce bias, right? Since the ellipticals are brighter and bigger
in
general.
I mean, I thought that was the point of some of the things that we heard earlier.
It's magnitude limited by supernovae. Supernovae.
So there are some supernova without pulse.
So let me just, yeah, I get what the question is then. So you find a supernova, and do you know whether it's in a galaxy equally well if the host was a spiral versus an elliptical? Or are you less likely to find the host if the host was a spiral?
Peter Nugent isn't here. He might argue that, in fact, you're less likely to find it in a large elliptical because the background is hot. But I
you
think
the
first order
the supernovas.
That they're equally likely no matter what kind of galaxy they went on. So this is irregardless of what galaxy, this is a volume sample of galaxy.
Yeah, so, well, in view of this result, we can see these are the typical values they get, 2.4, 3, 2.4, 2.6. And in some cases, they can exclude time delays younger than 1 gigayear. So what we did is to do the same analysis, choosing the different subformation histories I showed at the beginning. So in this case, I use an arbitrary parametrization. This is the Jabalisco et al. Optical subformation history. This is the infrared and the fossil records subformation history. And you can see that the Bayesian probabilities shift several gigayears even to negative values, more indicated than this. Subformation history is not correct. And in fact, it has been corrected now and goes up. You can also, instead of using bias and probabilities, since the distributions are so wide, it's difficult to tell where the 95% confidence level that you're going to choose. So you use KS test and you have
Can I be sure I understand what data you're using? So you're taking different star formation rate histories, that's fine.
Yeah.
But then you're taking 1A rate measurements as a function of redshift.
I'm taking the data, the supernova I showed you before. I'm taking this distribution of supernova. So the redshift distribution.
Just from one survey?
Yeah, just from the good survey.
Just from the good survey. So you're not using anything else but this data set?
Yeah, exactly. Because we just want to compare,
okay,
see what happens if you change the star formation history.
Okay, great.
That's why we use the same
great, thanks,
parameterizations as well. So then you can use a KS test to do the same, and you find the same result. And
what
was
that
H04 again? It's a Helen et al. Paper. It's an Nature paper.
This fossil is record.
It's fossil
record. That's the fossil record.
That's
the
record.
Oh, that's
him. It is. That's,
oh, that's fossil record.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's real. That's real.
So I'm a little worried here. You're using the KS test as a goodness of fit here. That is, you're going to say that if the KS deviation D is like greater than a certain amount, then you're going to reject the hypothesis.
Yes.
But that can only, that can't give you any parameter. Estimation confidence interval.
No, I just want to reject scenarios. That's the idea. So for this star formation history combined with the,
right,
the supernova, you will exclude time delays lower than 1 year ago with 95% confidence level. Why are we using a KS test? Because there are so few supernova that you have, we don't want to be.
But likelihood is, you know, much better, and you can do Bayesian inference with it. I mean, you can't use KS. You can only use KS to, you cannot use it to reject any parameter values or a range of parameter values. You can only use the KS to reject, you know, a particular scenario as a whole.
Well, this is for different time delays. This scenario is, this star formation history, time delay.
I'm saying, but what you're doing is you're using it to restrict a range of parameter values, and that's not the appropriate use of KS. It doesn't work.
I'm not sure. I don't think so.
We'll talk about it afterwards.
Yes.
I'm very experienced in these matters, and you can't use it. You can't do that.
Well, that's
it's used all the time in astronomy, but it's not correct.
I think for this case, given that the supernova are very few,
well, you can do is, you know, I mean, you can take two distributions.
We'll take. Sorry.
This is not.
So, you can use e-folding distributions, exponential decays. There's no constraint. And again, yes. So, the main conclusion is that the later peak the star formation history, the shorter the time delay you will get. We also did, we tried to constrain the binary population synthesis time delay distributions for different combinations of star formation history and BPS parameters. So here are different star formation histories, single degenerate, double degenerate scenario.
Sorry, what are BPS parameters?
Binary population synthesis. So in this case, it's a common envelope efficiency. And the first thing you can notice is that for this star formation history, the single degenerate channel will be excluded, but not for the others, with a more than 95% confidence level.
So the others, again, are not best correcting, you know, taking some derivative, is it possible, and what's the other one? Infrared background?
Yes, the cosmic infrared background. Starting in about 2001.
So when
they're all kind of indirect, they're wrong, but it's
yeah, so GO4 M2 is the non-dust corrected.
Yeah, this is non-corrected, non-dust corrected. Yeah, no.
So it's excluded.
And the second thing you can say that, well, all these models are consistent with a 95% confidence level. The best fit the double degenerate scenario with the infrared self-formation history. But this is just a proof of concept. It's not. And you need better sub-constraints on the star formation history to start doing the same. And we found that doing Monte Carlo simulations, unless the star formation history is really well known, we won't be able to tell the time delay distribution based on this test. So you have very precise constraints, but not very accurate. So we did, we assumed a star formation history and generated 1,000 random supernova. we derive the time delay using a different star formation history. So let's say the real star formation history is this one. And let's try to do the same analysis with a different star formation history. What would be the systematic effect of choosing the wrong star formation history? And we found it to be the order of 2 gigayears. So what I plot here is the Bayesian probabilities for a 1,000 supernova random sample, assuming that the star formation rate history is the optical syndrome corrected one, but using a different star formation history to derive the data. So you can see for the single digit scenario, if you assume that the real star formation history is Charyan et al. 2001, but you use this star formation history to derive the time delay, you will get time delays of the order of 2 gigayears, between 2 and 3. If this is the real one, but you use this to derive the data, you will get something of the order of 1.5. And if we assume the same one to derive the random supernova, and the same one to derive the time delay, we will recover the single degenerate scenario time delays. And the same happens with the double degenerate scenario. So there's a systematic error of the order of 2 gigayears just because of the uncertainties in the star formation history. That's the main conclusion. That's the point I wanted to make in this talk. And the second thing is this supernova rate in elliptical galaxies. So I don't think there has been much talk about this plot in the Lavalle et al. 2005. So we have to explain why elliptical galaxies that are radio loud produce more supernova 1As than the ones that are radio quiet. Since radio loudness is usually associated to shorter time scales, there's probably some short time scale associated to this result.
Stefan, can I ask you a question about the observations on that? With the radio loud ones that produce a higher rate, do you know offhand if the supernovae that occur in them tend to be toward the center of the galaxy, or is there no correlation between the position of the supernova and the position of the center?
They have, in the paper, they have pictures of the host. I don't think they're particularly very close to the center, not aligned with the jets or anything like that.
Thank you.
X-axis.
Ah, the morphology of the ellipticals, spirals, irregulars. So it's a Manucci et al. Result, plus radio loudness and radio quality. So, star formation in elliptic galaxies. These are papers from the Galaxy team. So please, I ask you to read them. It's very interesting what they're finding. So what the main conclusion they reach is that the UV color magnitude relation allows them to identify the last important episode of star formation in galaxies. Significant fraction of massive early type galaxies at low redshift exhibit levels of star formation undetectable in the optical but visible in the UV. Just repeating that. And the lower limit of the fraction of massive early type galaxies showing signs of star formation rate, star formation is of the order of 30%. And early type galaxies in the redshift range 0 to 0.11. have 1 to 3% of the star mass in star less than 1 gigayears old. So if this is true, do we need the long time delays? There's some problem here.
Do you know why do they interpret this as main sequence stars and not evolved hot stars, like as people have usually done, right? What's changed here? Because Yi, for example, a couple of years ago, was all talking about SDB stars. And,
right.
What's changed? Why is it suddenly main sequence stars?
I don't know. I'm not an expert, but these are the results. And
Just looking at you,
is this the UV upturn?
No, it's corrected by the UV upturn. It's corrected by AGN activity.
The question is, what is the UV data? Is it the UV upturn in ellipticals that they're using, or is it something else?
It's the near UV. It's the color in the.
It's the UV upturn.
It's the color index.
It's a color UV color magnitude. So it's a color index, and in galaxy can only be the two.
Maybe they're not going quite so far from UV. Maybe they're looking slightly nearer UV. Okay.
And they say that in optical this is degenerate. You cannot tell the difference between age, metallicity, and dust. And the near UV is clear. Point to them.
Yeah, but the question Tom's asking is basically, well, the other way of rephrasing the question would be one of, if all I do is lay down a population of main sequence objects and ask how the color evolves as a function of time. Right, but don't include anything further down the track in terms of binary interactions that might lead to things like SVBs, etc. Then you're missing out on contributions to the UV. So if they're not including binary evolution, for example, in some form, then they might just be missing something and interpreting it as general stuff.
I mean, we know in a few nearby ellipticals where HST has spectra of the UV upturn that it's an SVB star spectrum. So it tells you that it is the result of binary evolution, not due to stars being formed recently. So I just don't know from these, if these are Galax results, my memory was that these were all redos of the UV upturn, finding that it wasn't metallicity dependent. Because there had been an old result from IUE which showed that the UV upturn was metallicity dependent. But I think what Galax showed is that that wasn't the case any longer.
I think so. I know that they are aware of the UV upturn. They talk a lot about the UV upturn.
We discussed this, I guess, a few weeks ago anyway, yes. Right? I mean, this issue that as they look at ellipticals, mm-hmm. you do find evidence of dust and gas, and when you study the populations, there may be some degeneracy at optical wavelengths, but evidence of at least intermediate age populations. So it's at least consistent with what people find from other directions of evidence. Elliptical. Certainly, you know, there are ellipticals with star formation, as Ed pointed out earlier, when we looked at that one galaxy. That have had interactions, but I don't know that there's any evidence that ellipticals don't have star formation.
I think, like you said, I think that's fine. So 1-3% in stars less than, from an optical, I think you can say that too.
So I think the surprising thing is the last bullet is the one I think we've heard many times, that early type galaxies have had a few percent of their stellar mass formed recently. But the fact that 30%, the notion that 30% have high M dots,
mm-hmm. Well, it's just some single.
Well, what does recent mean? 1 giga year?
Yeah, 1 to 1.5 giga years. That's okay. What it's.
Yeah. But what's the M dot over a mass? Yeah, that's the question.
By M dot, you mean the star formation rate?
That's right.
They said that it could be similar, a big elliptical could be similar to a Milky Way.
It's so close. Well, it can't be ongoing.
Not ongoing now, but.
When it had a tiny burst.
But does anybody know from Sloan? There was a lot of work done at Sloan from H alpha for nearby ellipticals. I mean, Sloan had a tremendous amount of data. Does anybody remember that? There was a whole papers from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey about evidence from light emission of star formation in ellipticals, and there was some. But then again, it was a few percent, is what I remember.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point here is that where are the corpuscles? So you have to be able to form the stars and. When the stars are forming, either you say that the galaxy is not elliptical, or the stars are forming another galaxy that merge. But something, there's some, we have to explain the absence of core blobs.
I don't think so. If you look at the Sloan, something that the exercise that should be done is to take what we know from Sloan, the nearby galaxies, where you get the total star formation rate in ellipticals, and then ask, given that rate, should Kate have seen it? And I think the answer is no. Should they have seen it for? So the question is, the fact that you haven't seen it, it doesn't actually mean that it's been really constraining. That's all I'm saying. But that's an exercise that should be done. From Sloan.
They compare with Sloan data all the time. Yeah. I don't know. It's just to raise the problem because I haven't heard about this.
Is that 1-3% sufficient to justify the type 1a supernova rate in ellipticals? My impression was that you would have needed much more.
I think, well, this is the probably the stars we see are the tail of some distribution. but I don't know how long is the distribution, so it depends on that. It depends on the time delay. Yeah.
And there's actually a lot of stars, a lot of mass, even though it's not a small percentage, it's a lot of mass, and the overall rate is lower, so, you know.
That's I think you stopped to explain why ellipticals seem to show peculiar and subluminous 1As. If this was the same population as in spirals, then you'd expect the same type of, the same distribution of super 1As. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
Well,
again,
it depends on the time delay, though. Again, in spirals, you get some that have shorter time delays, and maybe, or you can, in principle, have some that come from more recent star formation than here. Just because you have young stars here doesn't mean that you're rich in the highest mass stars. But I don't know. We need to look at that in detail.
If that was a significant percentage, why don't you have 1 to 3 giga here now?
Okay.
You don't have like 1B or 1C or something.
So I think the interesting question. So we might all know the answer. So if you take in spirals, if you take the ratio of core collapse to 1As, it's 3 to 1. If that's also true for the star forming in ellipticals.
No, it's not.
I know it's not. But you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but my point is that when an elliptical is undergoing this star formation rate, I mean, this star formation episode, do we call it an elliptical or do we call it something else?
We could call it an elliptical, but if you took a spectrum of it, you would see some star formation. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've done spectra, you know, you have an elliptical and you see an H alpha emission, but it's a small fraction of what you get from a spiral. Mm-hmm. So, yes, you have to be careful, because morphology isn't the best way of doing it. But from what we've seen, you know, there are supernovae going off in galaxies that have very little or no star formation at all. And then looking at our populations, there are some, this is the Gallagher stuff, we can get ages of the populations, the dominant population, and they're, you know, 5 to 10 billion years old, and there are still 1As going off.
I know
there, and there hasn't been.
But this is not the dominant population. That's the point.
Right, but there's. I bet if Galax looked at those, I mean, you don't have Galax looking at the hosts necessarily. If Galax looked at some of these hosts, these ellipticals, they would not see any evidence of star formation. Is my bet.
Yeah, we should.
Or Spitzer could do this too, as we were discussing, possibly.
Yes. I think Peter, your comment about them being subluminous is also an issue, because if you have 1 to 3%, you know, then, you know, and you have a factor of 30 or 50 lower rate in the ellipticals than you have in the star forming, then that would mean that all of these should basically be the same as in the star forming. They should not be subluminous. So, I mean, that also argues that it's not the whole story here. The other thing was in the Swift ones, we had this nice example of potent elliptical with 2 1As going off in it, you know, and many going off in it recently, and it was some interaction. But those were, you know, I don't remember if any of those were subluminous.
I don't know either. I bet that they were not subluminous.
That's what I'm guessing too, which is, you know, further evidence that this isn't, you know, that there's the star-forming component, what you would expect to produce, you know, more normal luminosity 1As and not these subluminous ones.
I think in the end, the there's some star formation going on in ellipticals, and it is contributing to some of the supernovae, but I think there's still an old population that is producing some.
No, but the question would be how many of those?
Yes.
If you just take that rate, how many of the supernovae ellipticals will come from this star forming? And then whatever's left.
What was on that L5 part with the radio lab? Maybe that's. How do you
think that this is?
I don't know, maybe that's rough estimate.
That's a difference.
What it could be. So maybe factor, maybe half.
I don't know. So, well, continue. Sorry. There's another result from the galaxy people is that field ellipticals show less star formation. So that's also consistent with the Lavalle et al. Paper. So maybe we should look for this kind of signature in the Type 1A rate to study star formation in ellipticals as contributing to the supernova rate. So conclusions, so, well, based on the time delays, none of the theoretical predictable scenarios can be ruled out with more than 95% confidence. So this is based on the time delays. That's because the star formation mystery is too uncertain. The Bayesian probabilities show a peak at 3.5 giga-years, and this is mainly due to the absence of supernova redshift greater than 1.5. So it's the last bin of the supernova rate. That is what is giving you these long time delays. So star populations of host galaxies may give you better constraints, but the recent episodes of star formation are difficult to detect. The relevant ones are the order of 1 giga. And so elliptical galaxies are not entirely passive. And the question is, how many long time delay Type 1A supernova do we need? So that's what I want to say.
Further questions?
Everybody's done. Questions? Sweet. Great. Okay, thanks. Nothing. Can I just ask one thing? So this is what I'm trying to say. So what if you have an elliptical galaxy that undergoes a merger, you have a short burst of star formation, and then you see the Type 1A. So if, what happens if I put the Type 1A here? Would I see this in elliptical or something else? So that's the main thing. And the other thing is that Constellacy 2006 says that most elliptical galaxies are blue and start forming a red greater than one, so I wouldn't be worried by the other ways results.
What is that
from?
That's
a very interesting book. Maybe the next book.
So, comment here, so, because it's raised by whether these are happening in clusters or in the field, and whether ellipticals in clusters or in the field. And so, I mean, this is the reason I thought about this is because of the short GRB business, and how many are happening in clusters and so on, and are they happening in star-forming or elliptical galaxies. And one of the things that isn't well widely appreciated in the GRB community is if you look at the morphology of galaxies in clusters at CF1, it's about 50-50 between elliptical and spirals. But as you come to Z equals zero, then it becomes about 95% what are many people would call ellipticals and like 5% with spirals. But what really matters for the short GRBs, and it may matter here, is a lot of what are termed ellipticals actually aren't ellipticals. They're lenticulars, which have had their gas stripped, and they're just the bulge that's left when they go into the cluster. And those typically have recently been forming stars a lot, and they're not true ellipticals in the sense of the stellar population. They're actually spirals that have been stripped and then have lost the gas. So this is really can confuse matters tremendously if they're classified as ellipticals and think that they haven't formed stars for eons. No, they were forming stars quite recently. So this may also relate to what one concludes from morphology in clusters versus the field. The field is much safer.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing, most of the galaxies are in the field, right? So most 1As that are detected in the field, not in clusters.
That's true.
So the clusters are a little more problematical, but as long as you stick with the field, it shouldn't be a problem.
I guess one issue, though, is now what do we mean by an elliptical galaxy? I think that whole definition in terms of stellar populations in the past is based on incomplete data. So I think the idea that an elliptical is a system that only has old populations is something, but there's really a lot more subtlety to that. And so I mean, the so-called that pure also, elliptical, I mean, you know, may not exist.
I mean, two things are, one is what's the overall density of mass in the region, you know, that you're where the elliptical lies, and overdensities can vary from the field to clusters where it's very overdense and things are different. But then also, I would assume, like you're saying, that high redshifts, I mean, what's high, one or something higher than that, the frequency of mergers, you know, of some small star-forming galaxies with the ellipticals probably, you know, gets non-negligible.
Yes, contribution of 40% according to Rich et al. 2006. So, star formation rates.
But I mean, in that case, how much? What fraction of that 40% is one of the galaxies an elliptical?
I don't think
it's so much. But.
Rick?